Our environment is certainly facing a lot of challenges right now, and there are a lot of people working to solve those issues and challenges, and often they try to do it by convincing you and me intellectually of the importance of these issues and what we need to do to help. In other words, they're trying to educate us, educate the public. Wondering if those arguments really convince. Have you ever wondered about that? Maybe you're involved in an organization, and it's an environmental organization, and wondering how could we be more effective in reaching our public or getting what we want. Well, Tom Heberlein, who is a professor in community and environmental sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has written a fascinating book. It's called Navigating Environmental Attitudes. And he is a lot of things that he talks about here, but I think one of the most important things we can do to protect the environment is to figure out public attitudes and then work with them, maybe not try to change them. Attitudes can be kind of tough to change, as he so eloquently points out in his very entertaining book. Have you thought about how your beliefs are tied to your identity? How does that impact your position on environmental issues, for example? Have you acted in ways that were ever in conflict with your beliefs? I have. I've got some examples. Tom's got some examples of when he did it, too. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And we'd love to hear from you. Tom, welcome.
Nice to be here, Larry. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Tom and I go back a long, long way, I should say. I've been kind of friends for many a year, so I'll put that right out there. And, you know, you taught community and environmental sociology, and somebody's going to say, what the heck's that? What is it exactly?
Well, it's a department that deals with human behavior and society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of our environmental problems are not due to the environment. The environment does quite well all by itself. But our problems are tied to human behavior. And as we try to solve environmental problems, we keep studying the environment. We keep studying the animals. We're not going to solve our wolf conflict in the state of Wisconsin by collaring one more wolf. But we should be looking at those attitudes and the people that are involved and map those just as carefully as we map the rest of the environment. So that's sort of the plea at the end of the book, is that there's a lack of a balance in science. And so this little department in the College of Agriculture, I'm happy to say, has over the years pioneered studies of human behavior as it influences the environment. So that's where I grew up. I started in 1972 there, became one of the first professors of environmental sociology. I'm technically a social psychologist. I study humans at the interface. So as I've worked with wildlife managers, as I've worked with scientists, limnologists, park planners, all over the world, really, and they keep saying to me, well, attitudes are really important, and I agree, I'm nodding, they're important, and, you know, they can tell me about wolves, and they can tell me about electricity, and so on, and then it gets my turn, and they say, well, what about attitudes? How fast are they? How do they grow? What color are they? And all those simple questions I couldn't answer, and I used to describe them like ghosts. They were kind of like ghosts. Yeah, they're out there. And one guy said to me in a meeting, he says, yeah, he said, I don't believe in ghosts either, but I am afraid of them. And I said, you've got the exact point. You need to understand attitudes. They can derail major projects very quickly. So then I came up in working on this book with a better metaphor. And let me put the book up by the microphone.
So everybody
can see
it. Folks
can look at the picture here.
Actually, we have it on my Facebook page, so I got a picture of it right there.
You do want to see this, you can go to Larry's page. But the central metaphor of the book is captured with this picture. It is a raft in a big wild river in Alaska, and it is headed right for a rock.
It is.
And you can't tell whether it's going to get around that rock or not, so it's really got that tension. And I like to think of attitudes like those rocks in a river. You know, as we head down a river on a river trip, we don't load up our rafts or kayaks with dynamite to blow every rock out of the way. But that doesn't mean because we can't change them, they aren't important. You have to know where they are. You have to know how to read the water. You don't want to go down there blindfolded.
Yeah.
And you sure don't want to go down there not knowing about the water. So this book is a river guide to environmental attitudes that tells you how to run the river without moving the rocks out of place.
And it's a great metaphor. I really love it. And you have so many wonderful examples. This is a book that's probably going to be used in a lot of courses at the university and maybe elsewhere. But frankly, it's a really entertaining. It's unlike many of the textbooks that I've seen in my life, and partly because, well, you're a good writer, but also the many great examples you use. And maybe you could give us an example of.
Sure. I mean, some of them are so simple that you say, well, why didn't I think of that? Others of them are pretty complex but very powerful. Probably the simplest example of getting people to engage in a pro-environmental behavior is being used very frequently in Europe now, and only a little bit in the United States, but it's coming. When you go into a hotel rooms, back in the days of the energy crisis when I started doing work on energy and electricity consumption, you'd go into hotels and it'd be lots of notices, please save energy, we have an energy crisis. And this is what we call the cognitive fix, where we try to give people information. Social psychologists call this the knowledge deficit model. If you just people had the right knowledge, they would engage in the right behavior. So you saw all these signs. And, of course, when you leave the hotel room, you know, the light's on over there, and you're not going to walk back, and you're in a hurry. And then you think, they don't really care about the energy. They're just trying to reduce their electric bill so they make more profit. And you walk out, you leave the lights on. Well, I was in a hotel in Budapest working on this book, and I turned out the lights absolutely every time I left the room.
Yep.
Every time. Because you had a key card, and in order to turn the lights on, you had to put the key and a card in a little slot, and it put all the lights on. So it didn't matter whether I believed in global warming, hated global warming, independent of attitudes, I turned the lights off, and it solved another problem. I could always find my key.
So that's an example of it didn't make any difference what your attitude was.
Exactly. We just designed the system in order to get the desired result. Now, another very impressive case that I discovered, I made a lot of mistakes in this business myself, but was Hood River, Oregon. It's a town about an hour out of Portland. And in 1983, they got 91% of this community to retrofit, to put in new insulation, new doors, new windows, and saved an enormous amount of energy because they had so many people participating. Because of this, we have not built, the power companies in the Pacific Northwest started to do these retrofits system-wide because it was so successful in this one community, and we've not built new power plants in the Pacific Northwest since. This insulation was able to bridge over to the greener forms of energy, electricity consumption now. So they got these people to participate. I mean, can you imagine Heberlein and Mueller renting a truck and going to Hood River and say, we're going to insulate your houses? Even we're going to insulate them free.
Yeah.
If we got 10%, we'd think this was a big deal.
Great. Yeah.
And the way they got that was through a very careful set of attitude surveys, breaking the community into nine different groups, working on each of those groups independently, and following with continuous attitude surveys. So if something went wrong, and things did go wrong, they were able to capitalize on it and fix it right away. One of the best stories of this, showing you real community sociology, how it can work. And there were four PhD sociologists working on this from very good institutions, well-trained. This was not sociology on the fly. But in the midst of this, they discovered in their test houses they'd forgot to put a radon meter on. So, you know, if you re-insulate, the houses can be a lot tighter, and you could have a buildup of radioactive gas. So all of a sudden, you discover this, and they have to go back in and put these radon meters in. Well, you can imagine scientists in white coats, join our little experiment, and you're going to turn... You're going to be radioactive. I mean, that could stop the whole thing in a small rural community. Well, they realized the school needed band uniforms. So they went to the school and said, you know, if you will put out these cardboard boxes, these meters that measure radon, we'll buy uniforms for the whole band. And it worked like a charm. They did tell people in the newsletter that went out exactly why these meters were there and what they did. But could you imagine coming in with, you know, scientists with white coats? This whole thing could have gone down the tubes. So there's
instead, they
a
had
nice
band
example.
Members showing up.
That's right. Exactly. Locals in the community participating.
Attitudes are pretty hard to change, aren't they?
Yeah, they are and they aren't. And that's what makes the, that's why you need an expert to help. Social psychology, my field, has been studying these for 100 years, almost 100 years. We still don't have it all figured out, that's for sure. And so this book is sort of my experience. Some of them are based on direct experience and identities and full of emotion, and they're glued together by those things. And those don't move. I mean, if I wanted to change your attitude about musky fishing, for example, it's going nowhere. I know, I got this bag of attitude change dust, Larry. I'm going to spread it over you and watch your attitude toward musky fishing change. On the other hand, many of our attitudes about nature are, in the wolf studies, for example, there's about 25 to 30% of people who are totally neutral on wolves, and those are the folks who return our questionnaires, and we have survey response rates between 50 and 70%. So because of that big neutral group, you can see quick shifts, and that worries me about the future.
Tom Heberlein, our guest today, talking with him about his new book. It's a fascinating book called Navigating Environmental Attitudes, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our environment is certainly facing lots of challenges right now. People working to solve these issues often try to convince you of the issue's importance and what you need to do to help, but are these arguments really convincing? Maybe sometimes, but a lot of times, no. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Tom Heberlein taught community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. He's written a fascinating book. It's called Navigating Environmental Attitudes. And he says that the most important thing we can do to protect the environment is to figure out public attitudes and work with them, not try to change them necessarily. And he's here to share what he's learned and to answer your questions as well when you call in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back with Tom Heberlein right after this look at the news. Whether it's hunting wolves or sand fracking for energy, there are a lot of environmental issues that people feel strongly about. For those trying to influence public opinion and behavior, the first approach is often to make intellectual arguments, try to educate the public. But if our emotions and beliefs aren't engaged, well, will there really be much of a change? Larry Mueller here. Tom Heberlein, Emeritus Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology at UW-Madison, my guest. He's the author of a fascinating new book. It's called Navigating Environmental Attitudes. He's also a guest professor at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences at Umeå, Sweden. I think I've got the pronunciation.
Umeå.
Sweden. Tom, great, of course, to have you with us. Thanks so much for stopping by today. We're talking with him about, really, it's kind of a summation in part, really, of your life's work, isn't it?
It is. This book, in some ways, began even before when I went to the University of Chicago in 1963 down in Hyde Park in the city. And it was in the midst of urban renewal, and one of my mentors from Portage sent me a copy of Sand County Almanac. That was 49 years ago, and that was when the book was not very well known. And I started to read Leopold then, and it had a profound effect on me. Leopold comes up in my book quite a lot.
Quite a bit.
He enters as a real person. His words are important, certainly, but I treat him as a subject in my social psychological laboratory. So we dissect his attitude very carefully using principles of social psychology. We look at how his attitude toward wolves changed over 30 years. And we look at the what is well known in social psychology called the gap between attitudes and behavior. It's been the subject of a lot of research for the last 50 years. And Leopold, after he wrote his beautiful and brilliant essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, describing his changed attitude toward wolves, his very positive attitude toward wolves, a month after he finished the essay, he went to the conservation commission meeting. He was a commissioner, and he voted. Usually voting and attitudes are pretty close.
Yeah.
But Leopold voted to restore bounties on wolves after writing that essay. He's not unusual. I explain in the book why that happened, and I explain why it is so common for that kind of a thing to happen.
And we have callers online. By the way, you can join in, too, if you have a question or comment for our guest today, Tom Heberlein. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear what you've got to say. Rick and Toma, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, what do you do about situations where, you know, I've read studies that show that when people have strongly held beliefs, when they get contradictory information, their beliefs actually become even stronger. So what do you do about those kind of situations?
Why would that happen?
Well, first of all, that's a common phenomenon, and it shows you why it's so difficult to change attitudes. In Sweden, for example, I have an example. They put a man in jail for shooting a wolf that was intending, he thought, to jump in his sheep pen. And I have the newspapers from that, and I show my students there in the Swedish paper of two full pages with maps and circles and arrows. And I said, well, what if you hate wolves? You look at that and you read it and you say, isn't it terrible they put that guy in jail because he shot a wolf? You read every word of it. You think about it. What if you love wolves? Then you look at that and you read every word of it and you say, isn't that wonderful they put him in jail? Now, what if you don't care about wolves? And then you turn the page and it's a ad for a vacation trip to Thailand. And that's what you do. And so these things, it's why it's so hard to change attitudes, is people read stuff that fit with their attitudes, and the people who don't have very strong attitudes just move on. But I did have a experience in my class that I talk about in the book. You may remember the Exxon mine almost 20 years ago now when this happened, and they wanted to build a mine. And they wanted to change public attitudes, and they spent about $500,000 on a really good advertising campaign. These were on all the major markets. They were right on during the news. I'll bet Larry remembers them. There were ads that were hard to forget. Turns out they didn't work at all. The survey data showed people actually became more negative toward the mine. I wanted to learn more about those ads, and they weren't about to publish it in scientific journals, as you could imagine. So I had the vice president of Exxon Minerals come down to talk in my class, teaching a class on environmental attitudes. And so I brought him in, and boy, did he outfox me and change the attitudes of the students in my class. Students didn't like the mine, but they'd never heard of any of the arguments about why the mine might be a good thing and how the mine might affect their behavior. So he came in and pointed out that the students had computers. Oh, yeah, they were very proud of their computers. This was quite a while ago. Where did the metals come from? Well, the students kind of didn't know. And so, well, they come from mines, and there's copper. And they said, you know, we're going to mine somewhere, maybe in third world countries where there's no mining rules, or we can mine in Wisconsin. And the students had never even heard those arguments. They couldn't get away from them. As I say in the book, short of pulling the fire alarm, I couldn't stop this. And he really did change their attitudes just in that short period of time. Now, I could have prevented that through something we call inoculation theory. What you want to do to strengthen a weak attitude is to give people information ahead of time and also tell them that somebody's going to try to change their attitudes. And I had not inoculated them. Those attitudes had what we call a lack of a horizontal structure, a real spindly vertical structure. He knocked out the pins, and they changed their attitudes, and they were quite troubled about it, and I was a little embarrassed because I should have thought that this was going to come down the line. So when you can get information to people that have weak attitudes and not well-developed attitudes, they can change pretty rapidly.
Yeah. Tom Heverlein, our guest today, you can join in, too, with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Have you thought about how your beliefs are tied to your identity? Do you belong to an organization and you're out there trying to maybe get people to do something that you'd like them to do, and you have some questions about that, how you might better proceed? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 and email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You do separate attitudes from actions, and you show how they don't line up very well. Can you talk some more about cases where actions were altered but attitudes weren't?
I think the most interesting one is the Devil's Lake litter barrels. When I was a graduate student, I was very interested in environmental norms and littering. And as we all know, you're not supposed to litter. Mm-hmm. It's a relatively powerful norm. And I have my students go out and litter for assignments and then write a paper on what it's like to litter and what happened. And they hate that assignment. So I was studying litterers, and there was a particular theory, a norm deactivation theory, that I was trying to test. And in the process of doing that, I needed a sample of litterers. So I thought, well, this won't take long because everybody litters. I mean, it's just terrible. Look at all the litter that's out there. And so I went up to Wisconsin Dells, part of the main street. There's a railing along one side. It's about 25 yards. And we handed out useless handbills. The mimeograph said, register to vote. We handed these out, and then we're going to observe the litterers and then do a hidden interview, just a man mm-hmm. on the street interview, and then follow them up with a more scientific interview. So I thought, well, this will take a couple of days. Well, these people at Wisconsin Dells didn't litter. And I got angry with them. I mean, they were trying to ruin my study. We handed out handbill after handbill. We had to hand out 7,300 handbills to get even 120 litterers, and we couldn't see the litterers because when you break a norm, you don't throw it up in the air and yeah. say whoopee. So they'd sort of hide it. So we knew they were littering because we yeah. had the handbills on the ground. So we ended up with about 60 in the sample, which was just enough to do a fairly decent study. And the theory was predicted very well. The litterers from the non-litterers, but the point I missed in this experiment was that 98% of the people did not litter. They yeah. obeyed the norm. Now, 30 years later, I go over to Devil's Lake State Park just as a visitor, biked over from Lodi where I lived, get into the park, and they've taken out all the litter barrels in the whole park, picnic tables, no litter barrels. Well, the results were totally predictable. From my study, it was perfectly clean.
Yeah.
When my parents used to take me to Devil's Lake on a Sunday after church from Portage, do you think after we finished our picnic, if there was no litter barrel, my mother would have said, well, just toss it under the table, Tommy.
No.
The same people that were at Wisconsin Dells not littering didn't litter at Devil's Lake when you took the barrels out. And the DNR saved a lot of money from that. And that power of these social norms, nobody needed to be educated. You didn't have to put up any signs that said, don't litter. The people who use, the middle class people who use that park in family groups are not going to litter whether the barrels are there or not. Now, it needs to be cleaned up a little bit every day. I went over with the litter pickers one morning, and I have a bunch of pictures. You'd be amazed how little litter there is in the morning. You also have to deal with a new norm that could develop. The first year they did this, they thought, well, you know, people don't know we're taking the barrels out, so maybe we better give them litter bags so they can take the stuff home. So they had self-dispensers of litter bags. So people take a litter bag, put all their junk in it from their picnic, and then
leave it there.
They would put it carefully by the charcoal grill. And then the next person would say, oh, well, that's where I put my litter bag, next to the charcoal grill. So you had a new norm develop. And then along would come a raccoon in the middle of the night, and the non-litter would turn
litter
into litter. So after a couple of years of that, the park took those dispensers out. I said, how many litter bags did you distribute? They said, we don't know, but we saved $1,500 in litter bags just by getting them out, and still no litter. So it shows you the power of a norm here.
Yeah, and there's, I'm thinking about that, and going back, you mentioned muskie fishing early on. There was a time when we kept every muskie, you know, that we caught, and we used to always talk about, we'll have them stacked up like cordwood. And one time, 10 of us went fishing, and we had 8 legal muskies, and we actually
stacked them up
like cordwood and took a picture of them.
Well, you're a good example, and I use Leopold in here. Leopold also caught and killed fish. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the change in a norm. How does a norm change in society? That catch-and-release norm has actually changed pretty fast. It took only about 20 years.
Yeah.
I also have Leopold in here as a smoker. Yeah. Leopold died in 48, and by 1972, the same percentage of people in America smoked as when he died in 1948. Now, think of all the education that occurred during that time. Now in the 90s, the norm in the 90s, and certainly in this century, the norm has shifted. Yeah. We now have laws against smoking. We have major structural changes that have occurred. But the problem with this normative change, Larry, is that it's very slow. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we don't know in social psychology is how to change norms in the society. But boy, when it works, it works. I have this little story in here where I caught my first legal muskie, and I told everybody I was going to kill it and eat it in honor of my father and my uncles who always used to eat muskie.
They're really good.
And
they're tasty.
Exactly. And so there I catch my first legal muskie. After telling everybody this, I look at it, take a picture, and put it back in. That's how powerful norms are.
Yeah, I have not kept a muskie in, I don't know, 20 years maybe, something like that. And you're really kind of ostracized,
Well, that's the power of norms. You see, I don't know what your attitudes are, so I can't sanction your attitudes. But behavior is visible. And with that can come either informal sanctions from your friends, formal sanctions from the game warden if you break a law. And so norms deal with behavior, and that's what makes them so powerful and why we need to think more about norms and less about attitudes. And a lot of the sanctions are internal. When I send those kids out to litter, and I'm actually, you know, I can't send them out to rob banks, but I am making them break a law. I mean, it's illegal to litter, but it's a weak one. And so they go out, and I say, you have to litter in front of someone. And almost no one says anything to the kids who are littering. but the students themselves feel terrible inside. We call these internal sanctions of guilt and shame, and those are very powerful drivers. So the same thing with catching that, keeping a muskie now, if you were to keep mm-hmm. one, you would go home and you would not feel good about yourself, right?
No, no.
And even as you tell the story about stacking them up like cordwood, the same thing. It's, ooh, what did I do?
What did I do is exactly right. Well, how do we take this norm business, what we know about norms, and if we're in some environmental organization and we want to affect some change or we want people to support us? Or,
okay, sure. The goal is to focus on behavior rather than on attitudes. I picked up a study, which it did not get in the book. I was just finishing the book last November, done in Australia. A lot of get people to ride buses, right? And one of the things you do is advertise and say collective traffic's good and it's good to take the bus and it saves energy. And you know what we all do. We get out in our car. Well, what they did was did two things. One, realized that most of our powerful information is face-to-face, like you and I sitting here. The second thing is that people have a positive attitude toward taking a bus. They just don't quite know how to do it. So they would call people up, say, we'd like you to take the bus. You live a block and a half from a bus. If you'll agree, we will send you a packet of material on how to take the bus, where the bus goes, and we will give you a bus pass, and we just want you to take the bus once. Will you do that? They increased bus ridership dramatically by showing them how to do it. Then once they got the direct experience, there's four principles of attitudes, and one is direct experience. Once they got that direct experience, they got a more positive attitude toward the bus, and they knew how to do it. So focusing on the behavior rather than on the attitudes itself, liking buses is not the issue. It's how to and the interpersonal influence that gets them to that step.
Doug and Trevor, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. We have two lakes. I live in Trevor, Wisconsin. That's Kenosha County. We've had weed cutters for quite some time in the two lakes for the Eurasian milfoil and a few other weeds. And that's money from our taxes, and also the state gives us money through grants. Well, after that, probably about 10 years. And then it wasn't enough, so people wanted to use herbicides. And the DNR gave them the okay, and again, money from our taxes and through the state, through grants. I was just wondering, and I'm just a bit concerned with the herbicides because, you know, I use the weeds when they cut them to put in my garden, and thinking about the fish when I'm eating them, blah, blah, blah. And how can maybe I convince the people that it was good enough when we just had the weed cutters instead of putting these herbicides in the lake? And they give us warnings about when the herbicides were put in, and, you know, they're not too suggest maybe we could save money and it's not necessary, but they want when they fish or take their boats out, they want more weeds. The more weeds out, the better. And, you know, some people think, well, the weeds aren't so bad, we're cutting them already, but they want to use the poison or the herbicides.
Okay.
And I don't know how, you know, maybe this guy, your guest, could, you know, maybe a diplomatic way or something.
All right. Well, let's go there, Tom.
Well, I'm not a professor of public relations, but I can tell you in these situations are very common. And basically, what you need to do is to think about the other factors that are influencing behavior rather than these two beliefs that you suggested. From the point of view of the people that are supporting this, they have very good reasons for doing it. And we need to understand those reasons. We need careful scientific assessment rather than just guesses about why they do it and how they feel about it. We need to carefully measure how many people around lakes are doing this and to think about alternatives and other kinds of positive structures and rewards that might change their behavior, and then letting the attitude follow. Because if you just keep pushing on the issues that you raised, this is a very good example of what we call the cognitive fix, where you're just saying, if I could just give them information on how it's hurting nature, they will change their behavior. And I can tell you they won't. That there are many things influencing their behavior other than that single belief.
Thank you.
I got a tough road to hoe here.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Well, and just sort of to wind it up, you know, I think in we need quite a bit more social science research to help form our
policies. Guesses about why people engage in the behavior they do, and we're wrong. I'll give you a minute example. A guy with a Wolf license plate had X3 Emmer on it. And I thought, cross out three more. That's wild. The guy has a Pro Wolf plate and that. So I called him up and I said, why do you have that? And I said, well, I used to work for 3M and I really like that, so I'm an X3 Emmer. Not cross out three more wolves. So I guessed his attitude wrong.
Tom Heberlein, our guest, the book title, Navigating Environmental Attitudes. Take a look at it. I know you're going to enjoy reading it. And thank you for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Net.